From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we get the latest on the debate over genetically modified foods. My guests are James McWilliams, author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. In it, he challenges the idea that local organic eating is better for us. McWilliams also argues in favor of GMOs on the basis they could benefit the environment. We'll also hear arguments against genetically modified foods from Jeffrey Smith, author of Genetic Roulette. What are your concerns or questions about genetically modified foods? Join our discussion after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The debate over genetically modified foods has been a long-running one, a hot-button issue, and some recent news developments in that area. The European Union freed its 27 member states to make their own decisions on whether to grow genetically modified crops. The U.S., in reaction, says it opposes that decision. U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk suggested the EU's proposal would complicate efforts to end a years-long dispute over U.S. food imports to the continent. Genetically modified, or what we commonly call GM foods, are foods derived from genetically modified organisms. They have been regarded by some as Frankenfoods and portrayed in some media accounts as environmentally dangerous. But scientists say many fears about GM foods have found no basis in fact. So this hour, we want to talk with guests on both sides of the debate, both joining us by phone. James McWilliams is with us, author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Good afternoon to you, James McWilliams.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
I want to mention that you are an associate professor of history at Texas State University in San Marcos. Also joining us by phone, Jeffrey Smith, author of the 2007 book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods. Smith is director of the Institute for Responsible Technology based in Fairfield, Iowa, where Jeffrey Smith joins us. Good afternoon to you, Jeffrey Smith.
Good afternoon.
Let me start with you, James McWilliams. Remind us how widespread genetically modified food is in our typical grocery store as we walk down the aisles.
Well, it's hard to say. We know it's a lot, but because we don't have to label foods as GMO, we honestly don't know, and that's an issue that we can talk about. But, you know, we do know that upwards of 80, perhaps more than 80% of corn that's grown in the United States today is GMO corn, and the figure with soy is higher. It's closer to 90%. And, you know, given the centrality of those two crops in our overall food system, chances are very good that unless you're making a conscious effort to avoid GMOs, and it would really have to be a conscious effort, we're likely consuming them on a daily basis. Now, I want to add here that, and we can get into this down the line, that I don't necessarily think it's a good thing that we're growing so much corn and soy with genetically modified seeds. It's an issue of squelching diversity that concerns me very much, but that is certainly the case. It is everywhere. We've planted over 2 billion acres in crops worldwide in GM seeds, and we've been doing this for over 12 years.
Okay. We realize also in your book, one part of it is on genetically modified foods, and that's the focus of our show today. So give us your take on that. You talk about in your book how GM foods have been represented or misrepresented over time. What have you found out in your research?
In my opinion, the technology has been misapplied, and it's the misapplication of this technology by a handful of corporations that has led to a condemnation of the technology itself. My sense is that we're looking at a very powerful and potentially quite humanitarian and ecologically sound technology that has been largely hijacked by a few corporations to grow, as we just mentioned, corn, soy, but also cotton. And you know, these are crops that are grown, particularly corn and soy, to kind of fuel an industrial food system that many, many consumers are becoming uncomfortable with. They're with corn, it's increasingly grown to be turned into ethanol, and there are many, many studies that show this is just a completely wasteful way to use the crop. And so, you know, we're furthering monocultural systems, which is unfortunate because the technology, as many plant biologists and many nonprofits see it, could be used to diversify agriculture. It could actually be used to become part of dynamic and thriving organic systems. And the ability to incorporate traits such as drought tolerance or perhaps tolerance to certain bacteria or fungal infections could be monumentally important for growers in developing countries. And so it really does come down to how these seeds are being applied rather than the inherent evil, so-called evil, which we often hear about, of the technology itself. So
in fact,
an important distinction.
In fact, if I can quote from your book, you write, "One of the more overblown litanies of future destruction ever attached to a specific form of technology." You don't share the fears inherently in this technology.
I'm a historian, and I have to look at this in historical perspective, and I know that every technology is going to have a potential downfall, and sometimes those downfalls are manifested in ways we cannot predict. That said, I have talked to enough plant biologists who have assured me that over 12 years of growing this crop, you know, 2 billion acres planted, we have really minimal to no evidence that the genetically modified seed causes is dangerous to the humans who consume it. So, you know, on the grand scale of technologies to worry about, I'm certainly not going to say that there are no problems with it, and we'll never see a problem with it. But one would be foolish to say that about any technology. I drive up and down I-35 3 days a week, and I'm far more certain my life is endangered much more by that than eating genetically modified foods.
James McWilliams is author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Jeffrey Smith is with us, author of the 2007 book, Genetic Roulette, as we talk about genetically modified foods. Perhaps we'd want to, before we go to Jeffrey, I want to open our phones up to our listeners to ask your thoughts about genetically modified foods. Do you have fears about them when you go into your grocery store shopping? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Also on Twitter at IPRTalk. So, Jeffrey Smith, you have a different take. Your reservations about genetically modified crops and foods are quite different than James McWilliams. Paint the picture that of your concerns.
Well, back in the 1990s, we know from documents made public from a lawsuit that the FDA scientists who were asked to look at GMOs were uniformly concerned. They said that these crops could create hard-to-detect allergens, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. But the person in charge of policy was Monsanto's former attorney and later Monsanto's vice president, and the political atmosphere at the time was that the Bush administration had ordered the FDA to promote the biotechnology industry. So they ignored the concerns by the scientists and allowed the foods on the market without any required safety studies. Now, 14 years later, the evidence does verify the concerns by the scientists at the FDA. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine last year, after a review of literature, said that the current genetically modified research on animal feeding studies shows that it's linked causally with things like reproductive problems, immune system problems, accelerated aging, organ damage, gastrointestinal problems, and dysfunctional regulation of insulin and cholesterol. They specifically called for all physicians to prescribe non-GMO diets to all patients and called on the United States to put an immediate moratorium on GMOs. Right now, the current generation of genetically modified crops is fraught with unpredicted side effects because there's massive collateral damage in the DNA as a result of the insertion process and then the cloning process. So irrespective of what gene you put in, whether it's a vitamin A for golden rice or a BT toxin that kills insects, you cause changes in could be hundreds of other genes, which could cause turning harmless proteins into deadly ones. It could possibly increase the level of allergens, toxins, just what the FDA said and just what we're discovering. We see, for example, out of Moscow, two different studies which raise very serious concerns linking genetically modified soy to things like infertility and infant mortality. In both studies, one on rats and one on hamsters, there was a five-fold increase in infant mortality among the group that was fed genetically modified soy. And with the hamster group, by the third generation, most of the hamsters fed the GM soy lost the ability to have babies.
And I think you're referring to an article that you wrote in the Huffington Post earlier this year in April, which I read this morning, a Russian biologist, the lead on that. But also his quote in that, in your very own article, he says it is quite possible that GMO does not cause these effects.
Absolutely. And I was in discussion with him more recently, and he is following up. Unfortunately, the follow-up issue has been problematic. So many scientists who discover problems find themselves fired or stripped of responsibilities or having lost the funding. The scientist in Moscow in 2005 that discovered that more than half of the babies of female rats that were fed genetically modified soy died within 3 weeks, she was told by her director that he was receiving pressure from his director and she could no longer do any more GMO research.
Jeffrey Smith, hold on a minute. Let's get the view from James Williams quickly before we have to take a break in just over a minute. Sounds like a conspiracy theory almost, if I can put it in those terms, Jeffrey Smith. James Williams, why don't you have the same concerns that Jeffrey Smith has uncovered?
It's Mick Williams, and I wouldn't dismiss Jeffrey Smith's concerns at all. I think he's absolutely right to point out the revolving door aspect to the regulatory apparatus, and that's a political issue, and I would join Jeffrey Smith in trying to reform that. You know, what needs to happen with these studies, though, is there needs to be comparisons to conventional seeds as well, and this is one thing that a lot of scientific supporters of GMOs really become frustrated with, is that what is found for GMOs and, you know, with rats is often not undertaken comparatively with, you know, conventional seeds as well. You know, in a lot of ways, GMOs are, you know, they're a seed, and a seed is a seed, and they're all going to be engineered to have different traits, whether they're hybridized or whether they're genetically modified. And the studies very often don't undertake that comparison with conventional seeds as well.
James McWilliams is with us, author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Jeffrey Smith with us as well. His 2007 book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods. What are your thoughts about genetically modified foods? Exchange listeners, we want to hear from you this hour. Call us, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. What do you disagree with or agree with that you're hearing? Do you have fears about GM foods? Do you think about it when you're going down the shopping aisle? The exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email, 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Van Kiefer, today talking about genetically modified foods with James McWilliams, Just Food, his new book, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. He challenges the idea that local organic eating is better for us. We'll get to some of those points, I think, later in the hour. Also argues in favors of GMOs on the basis that they could benefit the environment. Jeffrey Smith with us, also author of Genetic Roulette. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to that point, James McWilliams, that you make in your book, that the idea that genetically modified organisms might be a way to improve the environment, might be a pro-environment to be in favor of using genetically modified crops in a certain way.
In a certain way is really the key phrase there. And, you know, these seeds, in many cases, have been engineered so that farmers can use less herbicide. They can use fewer pesticides. This certainly hasn't always panned out according to plan, but in many cases it has, especially with cotton. So there's that issue. But, you know, as I see it, the real potential of the technology is not being capitalized upon because GM crops are so limited right now, and there's very little support both politically and economically, to develop a wider diversity.
In what ways are they limited currently? Because in Iowa, I believe 80% of crops are genetically modified.
No, it's certainly fine for corn or soy. No, the support in terms of developing a wider array of crops, like, you know, say genetically engineered peppers or genetically engineered bananas to achieve certain traits, it's very politically and economically difficult to do that. Now, if that situation changed, you could very likely see a situation where farmers were able to employ these seeds to achieve the very same agroecological goals that a lot of people in the food movement right now are after by growing locally and growing organically. I mean, there's a strong push even for amongst a small group of scientists and organic farmers to incorporate GM technology into organic standards. It's obviously, as you might expect, it's not meeting with a great deal of approval within the organic community, but it's indicative of, I think, a broader sense, at least with certain scientists and farmers, that if this technology were used properly, it could further the goals of diversification, biodiversity, a lot of the goals that small farmers strive to achieve, because you could use fewer pesticides, fewer herbicides, perhaps achieve greater diversity of crop selection.
Jeffrey Smith, I want to get your reaction to that before we go to callers. Quickly, what do you think about that? Can you be both green and in favor of GMOs?
Not at this point. Maybe sometime in the future when we understand the language of DNA better. But right now, I also want to correct an understanding here about herbicide use. In the first 13 years of the use of genetically modified crops in the United States, it actually increased the use of herbicides by 383 million pounds, according to USDA statistics. There was a slight reduction in pesticide use of about 60 million pounds, but that didn't count the fact that the crops themselves, BT crops, are producing their own pesticide in every cell, and the amount that's produced in the field is actually probably twice as much as the amount that was saved in the spray form. Also, the process right now is so fraught with unpredicted side effects, and it's based on the fact that a single gene will produce a single result. That's not the way that most genes function. So things like drought tolerance and salt tolerance and also increased yield, that's beyond the scope or ability currently of genetic engineers. And they find over and over again that traditional crossbreeding is much more effective at these type of traits.
Okay, James McWilliams, very quickly, your reaction in regards to those reservations.
The statistic about the herbicide applications is correct, but it's important to point out that the herbicides that are used with GM crops are far, far less potent than that would be used otherwise. And the so I think that's an important point to consider. They don't run off. They degrade very rapidly. Now, the issue about unpredicted genetic responses to GMOs or to the technology, to the insertion of a gene, is incredibly complicated, and Jeffrey Smith is correct, but the regulatory apparatus on this is quite strict, and they do test for these kind of things as best that they can. And I want to point out that, I mean, every technology is going to have unpredictable consequences, and what I fear is that the benefits of this technology are going to be overwhelmed by an over-aggressive use of the precautionary principle. And the reason why I don't think we have time to do that is we're looking at a situation globally where we're going to have to achieve density of production. We're going to have to produce twice as much food on the same amount of land between now and 2050 to meet population expansion. So in terms of timing, I think that this is a risk that we should take right now. I think if you weigh the pros and cons, it is a sensible risk to take. And, you know, perhaps by 2050 we'll have a better and deeper understanding of the larger, long-term, currently unpredictable genetic consequences.
Exchange listeners, what are your thoughts when you hear these arguments, perspectives about genetically modified foods? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's squeeze in a couple calls, hopefully before the break. Anastasia from Ames joins us. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. So I guess I just wanted to address the point of unpredicted consequences. I'm a PhD student in genetics at Iowa State University, and I'm really interested in this topic of unintended consequences of that technology. And I wanted to bring up that there have been quite a few studies that looked at gene expression. That's like the amount and the number of genes that are expressed, like which specific genes are expressed based on environment, different types of non-transgenic varieties, and transgenic versus non-transgenic. And this has been done in tomatoes, potatoes, barley, a couple of others. And in all of these studies, they found that both environment and traditional breeding have greater variation in gene expression than biotech versus non-biotech.
Okay, so you're saying nature on its own or traditional crossbreeding has much more of an effect than what we can do in the laboratory. Is that the gist of it, Anastasia?
Well, I mean, as far as specific traits go, we can put specific traits into plants or animals that it might take a very long time, or maybe it wouldn't even be possible to do with traditional breeding. But when you look at the genetic level, actual gene expression, there's more natural variation that the plants responding to changes in the environment or because of all the different combinations of genes that might be present in naturally bred varieties.
And you're saying this should dispel our fears that we might have about genetically modified organisms?
Well, I still think it's appropriate to conduct testing and things like that, but I think that when we compare traditional breeding, mutagenesis, which is also included in organic farming, and other crop breeding methods, there isn't any inherent risk in biotechnology compared to those other methods.
Okay. Very interesting to hear about your expertise. Jeffrey Smith, a reaction to that. No inherent risk, she says.
Well, I want to sort of update some of that information. There was in the Journal of Proteome Research in 2008, someone did show that, for example, Monsanto's corn variety, Mon-A10, which is the most popular, it had never been evaluated by the FDA and the regulatory apparatus for these massive undetected side effects, and they found 43 different proteins that had dramatic changes that were different from the traditional corn. In fact, one gene, which is normally silent, was switched on in the corn that produces an allergen, and that several of the proteins in the corn had changed their shape and truncated, which might change a harmless protein into a deadly one.
Okay, we have to take a break in just a moment. I want to get a reaction from our caller who has been studying genetics at ISU in Ames. Anastasia, are you still there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I lost the last part of what Mr. Smith said.
Oh, you did. Okay, so can you react to any part of it about the risks that he sees there?
Oh, well, what I'd like to say is that they compared the Mon-A10 to a non-transgenic similar variety. But did they also compare a diverse panel of corn cultivars?
We're getting into the lingo here. I think we might have to broaden our perspectives when we return from our break
that.
Here, Anastasia. Nevertheless, thank you very much for your perspective. Anastasia calling from Ames. If you'd like to join our conversation with your thoughts about genetically modified foods, do you have fears about GM foods? Do you think they're being misapplied, as our guest James McWilliams, author of the new book, Just Food, seems to feel? Jeffrey Smith with us, author of Genetic Roulette. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter, @IPRTalk. Back with more of our conversation in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour. Great to have you. As European countries struggle with how to handle genetically modified crops, Iowa has much in stake in the debate here. And tomorrow on this program, we continue with our look at genetically modified organisms, crops, foods, more in the tilt of science and production on tomorrow's program. My guest tomorrow's program, the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, also William Beavis of the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University, and a couple of Iowa farmers with their perspectives on the ground, in the fields. What's at stake for Iowa in the debate over GMOs? That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today with us, we're also talking about genetically modified foods, crops. James McWilliams with us, author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. He is also at an associate professor of history at Texas State University at San Marcos. Jeffrey Smith with us, author of the 2007 book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods, joining us from Fairfield, Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. James McWilliams, one of the overarching questions in your book, how can we both collectively and as individual consumers achieve a sustainable global diet? And also thrown into that, how do GM foods fit into that? What did you find out about in your research about when we shrink it down to a micro level, on the individual level, can GM foods be good for us? Are they harmful?
Well, you know, I think the question is really kind of loaded. And let me put it in perspective, and this links back to the previous caller's, I think, really interesting point. We have this sense that The further we move away from nature, the more dangerous things become with our food supply. And when the general public hears terms like biotechnology and genetic modification as it relates to the food they're eating, understandably, they become quite nervous. And there's this pervading sense that, you know, if we just kind of leave it up to nature, that things will be safer, things will work out better for us and our food will be healthier. And that's an even more dangerous idea, I think, because, again, as a historian who's looked at the history of agriculture, the history of agriculture is about controlling nature. And for much of it, farmers control nature with very little regard to the environment. And it's only now that we're actually starting to think about the environmental consequences of agriculture. And as we look at the changes we've made agriculturally, in historical perspective, what we're doing right now with GE crops really is part of this larger effort to enhance yield, to reduce the inputs, harmful inputs such as herbicides and pesticides, and to hopefully down the road create a food supply that is more affordable, more accessible, and more reliably productive. The history of agriculture is strewn with suffering because farmers have been unable to control a wide variety of circumstances. And what we're seeing right now with GE seeds is a very powerful and potentially very humanitarian way to control the way we grow food, to stabilize our food supply. And none of this is to ignore the way that it's currently monopolized and being mishandled, but nonetheless, I think that it's important for us when we evaluate our fears about this technology to see it in historical perspective, to understand that, you know, it's part of this larger effort to actually make nature do our bidding, and it's really only in the last 50 years that we've started to pay attention to this in environmental terms, and I do not see why genetic modification can't be part of that larger environmental effort.
Okay, let's go to our callers. Plenty of callers, emailers. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll get to as many as we can in the remainder of the hour. Dan is joining us, first of all, from Des Moines. Good afternoon, Dan. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to make one comment on something that Jeffrey Smith said, that bioengineered plants produce their own insecticides, and that's true, but it's a little bit misleading. It implies that they might be harmful to people. The most commonly produced insecticide are the proteins produced by the bacteria Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, and those proteins for years have actually been used as an organic insecticide, especially in produce production, and there are some legitimate concerns about whether or not this insecticide is being overused, but as a resident of Iowa, I feel much more comfortable knowing that those kinds of organic or natural insecticides are now being produced by plants in place of synthetic chemical insecticides that were used before.
Let's get a reaction from Jeffrey Smith. Jeffrey.
Well, I think this is one of the myths by the Environmental Protection Agency and the genetic engineering community that BT toxin, which is produced in every cell of a plant, is safe. It turns out that when the Italian government fed BT corn to mice, they had massive immune responses. When the Austrian government fed BT and Roundup corn to mice, they had less babies and smaller babies. I think more importantly, we know that the natural spray that this caller was talking about isn't safe on its own. A peer-reviewed published study showed that about 500 people in the Pacific Northwest developed allergic and flu-like symptoms when they were exposed to BT spray. Now thousands of farm workers who are picking BT cotton in India, which produces thousands of times more concentrated version of this toxin, they're experiencing the exact same symptoms. Thousands of people are getting itching all over their bodies, rashes. When they allow animals to graze on the BT cotton plants after harvest, thousands of sheep, buffalo, and goats have died.
Mm-hmm.
And we see also that, unfortunately, the only human feeding study ever conducted showed that the genes transferred into genetically modified crops, in this case it was soybeans, transferred into the bacteria inside our intestines and continued to function. If this were to happen from eating a corn chip with a BT toxin gene, it might theoretically turn our intestinal bacteria into living pesticide factories, and this has never been evaluated by any regulatory apparatus ever.
Jeffrey Smith, hold on, please. Let's go to James McWilliams, who's done a lot of research in this area. You've written about you've surveyed the research, a lot of the research on BT corn. What conclusions do you come up with, also in reaction to what Jeffrey Smith just said?
Sure. Well, I mean, I perhaps not surprisingly agree with the caller that, you know, of all the alternatives, this is a fairly safe approach. And the fact of the matter is, there, you know, you can take any substance and find problems with it, and you can stuff it into mice and you're going to get consequences. What hasn't been pinned down, to the best of my knowledge, what hasn't been down is that if indeed, you know, BT is causing allergic reactions, what's the biochemical process? What's the biomechanical process making that happen? That hasn't been pinned down. I mean, agriculture is obviously full of variables, full of factors that might interact in ways to lead to skin rashes or cattle getting sick. And the pinpoint or the smoking gun that we might wish to find, or that some might wish to find for BT as the causal factor, has not been found. And again, sort of backing up and thinking about what that means, to me it means, yes, there could be problems with it, but right now the evidence isn't strong enough, given the benefits, to ban it or to abandon this technology. One other thought is that the cat is out of the bag, really, with genetic modification, with genetically modified seeds. I mean, this is a growing technology. It's becoming increasingly popular. And I think this might be one area where Jeffrey Smith and I agree. I think the regulation of it does need to be quite earnest and quite robust. And, you know, I think we'd be much better off having a discussion about how to regulate, effectively regulate, this agricultural technology, rather than talking about how we're going to get rid of it, or theoretically what the world would be like if we didn't have it. Because just realistically speaking, at this point in time, I don't think that's a possibility.
James McWilliams, thank you very much. Jeffrey Smith also with us. Thank you for the call from Des Moines. Dan, thank you. And let's move to Sharon, who is calling from Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
This is referring in some ways back to some comments that have been made already about controls with these various scientific studies. There's a criticism of the Russian studies for not comparing against something that was non-GMO, and a criticism of the graduate student who called. So there's a criticism saying, was it compared against normal, quote-unquote normal, non-genetically modified GMO cultivars. If our food supply is as permeated with genetically modified corn and soy as it seems to be, what's our control group? You know, for human health effects, if the entire population of, you know, the United States at least, is being exposed, against whom are we comparing?
Well, can we can look at ourselves. The control group would be the human population before, now that we have 14 years of this, before genetically modified foods were introduced into our food chain. And James McWilliams, as a historian, there were claims of really awful things to come that didn't bear out, right?
Hey, is this a question for me?
Yes, James McWilliams.
Well, I think it's true that, you know, you can go back and take any agricultural technology and you can see doomsdayers saying this is going to lead to this effect or this negative effect, and it never has ever borne out to the extent that the doomsdayers say that it would. I don't want to make it sound like that I have a complete faith in technology. But I also think we have to realize that agriculture, and this is like a point that really rankles a lot of people, but agriculture is essentially the choosing the lesser of evils sometimes. I mean, we've been doing this for 11,000 years. Humans have been around for a lot longer than that. So maybe the control group could be the hunter-gatherers. But, you know, agriculture, it can be nasty business. And what we're doing is we are, with a tremendous amount of hubris, manipulating nature to make it feed us. And that act in and of itself, if you kind of think about it philosophically or place it in a long historical perspective, is unsettling. And so I become, personally, I do become frustrated in discussions with a lot of people who in the sustainable food movement, because there's this sense that it's somehow possible to provide food for, well, 9 billion people by 2050 without risk and without environmental harm. I'll stop there.
Yeah, we have a lot of emails, phone calls to share. Carver and Ames, to that point, writes, the need to expand production to meet population needs is somewhat fallacious. First, we waste something like 40 to 50% of the food which we produce in the developed world, so more efficient use of food can help to a greater degree to expand our capacity. Secondly, writes Carver, dramatically cutting our meat consumption would be healthier and expand our capacity to feed humans by several fold. Also, this email from Beth in Clark County, she writes, I want to know what I am purchasing to feed my family and myself. I want to be able to choose. I want labeling. I am really concerned about genetically modified foods. We need to look forward for seven generations and be concerned about how what we do for the moment will affect them in the future. That from Beth in Clark County. Let's go to Rob in Cedar Rapids. Rob, are you there?
Yes, hi. Thank you. And praises to public radio for these kind of discussions. Two things. First, I like to go back to Upton Sinclair's comment that no man can be expected to do the right thing if his job depends on doing it. You know, I think sometimes we get this momentum on the things we do, whether it's genetically modified products or whatever, and then all of a sudden that's all we can do because we have to defend what we're doing even if it's wrong. And the second thing is going back to the idea of, do you remember margarine back in the 1950s, you know, this cheap alternative to butter, and how all of a sudden today we're going, oh, gee, hydrogenated products are bad, and perhaps we're in the same situation with high fructose corn syrup where we're going today, oh, well, gee, it's a cheap alternative. And so we do need to make the public know what they're getting, what they're buying, that it is whatever these things are, and that, you know, boy, the momentum of these things, once they get going and a big company starts marketing them, boy, watch out, because, you know, they're not, no, even like with ethanol in gas, it's like, well, gee, this is a cheap alternative, but nobody's ever going to admit that they're wrong.
Okay, very good point. Thank you, Rob, from Cedar Rapids.
Thank you.
Historian James, 14 years is not long enough from a historical perspective to see whether things are safe. Would you say, James?
Well, and when is it long enough? I mean, it's a very difficult question. And in terms of interests, I do want to point out that I have absolutely no corporate interests. I'm not linked with any corporation. I don't take money from any corporation. I'm not on any boards. I get that a lot, just even speaking cautiously optimistically about this technology.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your caller's point is excellent. Sometimes we seize on the truth of a certain agricultural or environmental idea, and once we seize on it, you know, we're going to read the studies just to confirm our opinion. And I often feel like the research that I encounter is sort of like biblical interpretation, in that you can go to the studies and sometimes you can just find what you want. And, you know, to me, what this ultimately means is, as we think about complex topics like genetic modification, it's very important to see the pros and cons of it, and not to reduce it to a black and white issue. And this is something that I see happening in the public discourse, not only with genetic modification, but with organic agriculture, with, you know, conventional meat production, with fish farming, et cetera. And just in general, as a larger point about how we talk about these issues, I think we're going to be a lot better off down the road and actually achieve real gains if we are able to have an open mind about them, see the gray areas.
Thank you, James McWilliams. We're coming to the end of the hour. I want to go back to Jeffrey Smith. You've raised a lot of your concerns, Jeffrey, this hour, author of Genetic Roulette, about genetically modified crops and foods. Is there anything good that you have to say about GMOs? Can you see the promise if we see what James McWilliams says is a sort of misapplication of GMOs? Do you see promise out there too? Do you see any common ground between those who oppose and those who employ GMOs?
Well, I'm not against genetic engineering per se on a theoretical basis. But you see, right now it's an infant technology, and we're feeding the products of that infant technology to the entire population, and releasing the crops into the environment where the self-propagating genetic pollution is not able to be fully recalled. Now, there was a concept that we should be able to see easily if someone has gotten hurt from eating a GMO. Actually, it's very difficult. You know, when GMOs were introduced in 1996, 7% of Americans had three or more chronic illnesses. In 9 years, it nearly doubled to 13%. Childhood allergies doubled in less time. Food-related allergies doubled between 94 and 2001. I have many doctors that come up to me after I speak at medical conferences telling me that they've seen dramatic changes in their patients since GMOs were introduced.
Yeah, but we see so many variables at work
exactly.
on the population,
and
to say that GMOs are responsible is hard.
We can't, but what we have to do is we have to treat it responsibly and do the studies before the stuff gets on the market and look at what's happening. I mean, there's so many times that Monsanto introduces a product and then independent studies find out later, oh, there's a sevenfold increase in an allergen. There's a doubling of an anti-nutrient, that the genetic construct didn't work as they intended. So many things do go wrong. It's not just theoretical. It's written about over and over again. But the scientists, when they raise their voice, they're typically silenced because of the overwhelming economic interests that are now tied with the political interests.
Let's squeeze one more caller in. Sonia, joining us from Cedar Rapids. Sonia, hi.
Hi. It's a wonderful conversation. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a senior at Iowa State University in agronomy, and I feel that GMOs are really just a Band-Aid to a larger problem that we have in our food production system. The root of the problem is that we are treating our food production system. We're treating the land as we're mining. We're soil mining. We're not farming correctly. We wouldn't need GMOs if we farmed correctly. They need GMOs for to protect against insects and weeds, but if they rotated their crops and they used different crops, they increased the diversity of the fields, the need for these GMOs wouldn't be there. And I think this is just they're trying to put a Band-Aid on something that's a bigger problem.
Okay, Sonia, very good. Thank you for that comment. Calling from Cedar Rapids, that'll have to be our last caller here. Let me throw that over to James McWilliams with some concluding remarks, because diversity is something that you talk about in your book, Just Food, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the caller is right, but it reminds me a little bit of this kind of recent argument out there that as civilization has gone downhill since the introduction of air conditioning. And boy, if we just never had air conditioning, we wouldn't have had sprawl and highways and fossil fuels with cars and everything. I mean, it's sometimes hard to acknowledge as environmentalists, and I consider myself a strong one, that we have inherited a certain deck of cards that we may not like. And so the fact that we have inherited agricultural systems that are industrial, monocultural, and have been remarkably supportive of population growth means that we have to work within those constraints. And I would love it if we could live in a world where we didn't have to use agricultural chemicals and we could grow enough food with the resources we have to feed the population, but I'm not confident that we can do that. And it's certainly not a gamble I want to take. So for now, I think we have to mine the soil but do it as responsibly as we can. And I would point out finally that a lot of GM crops allow for no-till agriculture, which actually has the point of preserving soil nutrients.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. James McWilliams, thank you very much for joining us by phone from Texas, author of the new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Also, thanks to Jeffrey Smith, author of the 2007 book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Smith, director of the Institute for Responsible Technology based in Fairfield. Want to thank our callers and emailers this hour for the outpouring of opinions, perspectives from you. And remember, tomorrow we will be following up with our continued look at GMOs, the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, also the William Beavis of the Plant Sciences Institute at ISU, when we talk about the science and production of GM crops tomorrow on this program. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.